It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. J.K. Rowling has a new novel. She's moved away from Harry Potter, the boy wizard whose stories prompted millions of kids to obsess over books big enough to serve as doorstops. Having concluded that series, she's written a novel for grown-ups, a story of troubled teenagers and their even more troubled parents. A local politician in an English town drops dead, prompting people who knew him not to mourn, but to start asking what his suddenly empty seat on the town council could mean for them. There is no magic in the casual vacancy, though readers of the Potter books may well recognize Rowling's acute and often painful observations of human nature. Why write this book on this subject?
Because, as I think most writers would tell you, I just needed to write this book. It was an idea that came to me in 2007. I had the idea actually in the States. I was on tour promoting the last in the Potter series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and I was on a plane and had the idea for the casual vacancy. And exactly as had happened with Harry Potter, I knew it was something I really, really wanted to write. I became excited about the idea of writing it. It's a very personal book in a lot of ways. It's not a memoir. I'm not in the book. It's not my story. But it does address themes, subjects that are very important to me. And so that was the starting point.
Started on a plane in the United States. I wonder why there, because it was a plane and you had time to yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there appears to be something to do with vehicles and movement that stimulates my writing idea, the ideas for writing part of my brain, because obviously it was a train with Harry Potter. I think I wasn't actually on my own. I was traveling with my family and with people from my publisher, and I can't even tell you why I had this idea at this time, but there it was. The basic idea was for a small town election, occasioned by the death of a man who had been a lot of things to a lot of people in the town, and what happened in the aftermath of his death. And even then, I knew that there would be an element of subversion in the story. And that comes largely from the teenagers, in that they attempt to influence what's going on because of their own person, each of the teenagers who does start getting involved in attacking the candidates for the empty seat has their own personal agenda. But I wouldn't want to go much further on that because it gives away a lot of the plot.
Oh, sure. But I think it is fair to point out, as you do, that even though there are a lot of adult characters in this book, in the end it does revolve around young people, a handful of them.
I think, yeah, the teenagers definitely drive the plot. There are five teenage characters, and they are simultaneously victims, protagonists, and in one case, I suppose that the whole plot revolves around the question of what we do with someone like this particular teenage girl who's Crystal. She comes from a very deprived family. She's rather disruptive in school. So I suppose if I had to sum up the plot in one question, it would be, what do we do about Crystal?
And I think it's not giving away too much, because it's revealed early in the book that she comes from this disadvantaged background, that she's looked down upon, that people at school presume that she is misbehaving, even though she feels that she is not. And maybe the only person who has been friendly to her is this politician who is, at the very beginning of the book, he drops dead.
Yeah, she does. Yeah, she absolutely. I mean, the person who arguably could have shaped her life the most is the man who dies in the first two pages of the book. He is someone who came from a background not dissimilar to hers, who managed to escape a background of poverty and criminality. And in a way, he's gone back into the area that he grew up in and tried to rescue someone else. And that effort was centered upon Crystal. So that's obviously a situation pregnant with possibilities for a novelist. So, but she does have connections with other people. She has friendships with other girls, and she has a boyfriend. In the course of the book, we examine what happens with her boyfriend. So There are just a lot of aspects to her situation that interest me, and some of, in some ways, for very personal reasons, because, as is very well documented, I too have passed through a period of poverty in Britain and can understand some of those issues.
Give me a better idea of what you mean there. Explain that for people.
Well, I think that I've had a very strange life. I've passed through a lot of different economic states in my life. My family was not particularly well off, although I came from a middle class and pretty well educated family. I attended a school very like the school that's depicted in the book, which means that it's a state-run school full of children from all kinds of different backgrounds. And then there came a point after the breakdown of my first marriage when, as I say, is very well documented, I existed on, for a while exclusively, on welfare, mm-hmm. on what we call benefits and you call welfare. So at that time in my life, I was, I certainly had contact with people who were living an existence not too far from the Whedon family, which is the family that Crystal comes from.
Well, maybe this is a good point to notice that this novel deals a lot with class differences in Britain. There is a town with a kind of old guard of more upscale people. There are public housing developments that have been built to the great resentment of the town on the edge of town, and there are people there that the old timers in town really, really resent. There's quite a divide that you explore here.
Yeah, I'm exploring what I think are maybe quite universal themes. They're certainly, I think, very relevant in Britain today and probably relevant in a few other countries too. But yes, there are class divides. For me, there are two families in the book that represent an evolution in our society. One of them is the Fawley family, who might be seen as... they make very few appearances in the book, and their value is really symbolic in terms of the plot. But they represent the true old guard. They have aristocratic antecedents. They live in a very beautiful house, and yet they still have a residual influence on this small town. And then you have the Jawanda family, who are we have a family who are of Indian descent, a very high achieving family, and in some respects this is the new order. This is a family that, on the basis of merit, has become the most affluent family in town. And when I say merit, I mean they've clearly worked themselves into a position of affluence. They are a two-doctor family. But there are issues that come along with being who they are, too. And they were an interesting family for me to explore.
Would you help us understand a little bit the class system in Britain? Because...
Oh, I listen.
I would suggest. Well, I
am
I,
not,
we don't
Steve.
Have,
I'm
we,
not qualified to do it. I'll say that I'm really not qualified to do it because I think you could ask 10. This book's set in England, so I'm going to say English, although I now live and work in Scotland. But I think you could ask 10 English people the same question about class and get a very different answer. It's a very contemporary question, you know, it's a very topical question. Social mobility is one of the great issues of the day here, as I'm sure it is in America. It's a bit of a hot topic at the moment. I suppose class in England is seen as a little more regimented than it may be in other Western societies. Possibly because we still have a royalty, mm-hmm. but it's a difficult subject, and it would very much depend on who you speak to, whether you're taking a socioeconomic model or whether you're talking about ancestry. I honestly don't feel I'm qualified to judge. I grew up in what I would call a lower middle class family. Not too far back, this was a very working class family. So I don't think that I had I know for a fact I didn't have a very grandiose upbringing, and I'm not really qualified to speak about this subject of class except from my point of view.
Well, I'm curious if you, as you went through the changes of your life, if you had difficulty being accepted by people from other classes, even as you started making lots of money.
I would say, no, I wouldn't say that happened. I would say that I have many times met with the assumption that my attitudes have changed much more than they have towards people who are still in the kind of situation I once was. In other words, well, I can think of a very recent example. I don't know whether you'll know this expression, but a man said to me, He told me where he lived, and he said, now, of course, we have no riffraff around there. And by, you do understand the expression clearly.
Yes.
And his assumption was that I would be glad to have kept out of my area the kind of person that I used to be, because I think, you know, not that long ago, he would have considered me riffraff too. So, yeah, that can be an interesting experience, that people make certain assumptions about how your beliefs may have changed or evolved, along with earning more money.
Did you say to him, hey, I'm riffraff?
Well, we did have a little conversation I don't really want to repeat on the radio.
Oh, okay, that's fine. You know, you mentioned this girl, Crystal, who symbolizes mm-hmm. some of these divides. You have a lovely quote that I took the liberty of writing down, which is describing an encounter Crystal has. She's gotten in trouble at school. She's accused of something she didn't do. She's sent to a guidance counselor. And there's this sentence which I felt said a lot about the character of a guidance counselor and also a lot about the kind of young person who's there. Tessa was used to the anger of students, Tessa being the guidance counselor. Tessa, mm-hmm. the guidance counselor, was used to the anger of students she saw most often in guidance. Many of them were devoid of workaday morals. They lied, misbehaved, and cheated routinely, and yet their fury when wrongly accused was limitless and genuine.
Yeah.
That really rang true for me.
Well, thank you, because I was a teacher in schools not unlike this one. I wasn't a guidance teacher, but that certainly was my experience. I think that when people are very damaged, they can often meet the world with a kind of defiance that Crystal, and in an even more extreme form, Crystal's mother, Terry, exhibits this automatic denial, this wish not to take responsibility for anything, this fear that if fault is found, they will be condemned and ruthlessly punished. I think that both the girl and the mother feel that way. And I saw that a lot when I was teaching. And yet it can and does often go hand in hand with a very routinely cavalier relationship with the truth and with what you and I would consider very basic morals. Yeah.
But if you get to that point where they're actually unjustly accused, they'll dig in.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yes, it's one of the great problems for me is that the poor, and I can here only really speak about Britain, though I suspect this is a fairly universal attitude. The poor are so often discussed just as this large, shapeless mass. You lose your individuality a huge amount when you have no money, and I certainly had that experience. You just become a statistic, and in person you become very depersonalized too. You don't have an answer to the question, what do you do? You become part of a problem. You're someone who stands in a line to get money. It's not where you want to be. And you become very voiceless. And Crystal has a very loud voice in the book, both literally and metaphorically. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to give a character like that a good, loud, strong voice.
And she is defiant in any way that she can be. She'll moon people. She'll speak up. She'll talk back to people who are they think they're better than her.
Yeah, absolutely. But behind that, of course, behind that toughness, it lies a huge, almost limitless vulnerability. That's what she's trying to disguise. And I think the novel shows that. You realise how fragile she is and how aware she is of her own situation, which for me is one of the most touching things.
You know, reading this, the young people at the centre of it are sympathetic characters because they're young and you want to root for them. But just about all of the adults are, in one way or another, horrible people, or at least people doing horrible things. Almost the only sympathetic adult through the novel is a guy who drops dead in the first chapter.
I personally wouldn't pitch it quite that strongly, but
okay.
But I hear you. I think that all of the adults in the novel, quite deliberately, are struggling with their own problems and issues. There are certainly two characters in the book, both of them male, and I think you'll know who I'm talking about, who I think are moral dead ends in a way. I don't think there's any appealing to them. I don't think they have better natures. One of them is the father of one of the teenage characters, and another is a drug dealer. But between those two men, who are almost the bookends, between which so much of the action takes place, I think there's a great range of behaviour, and I think that one can sympathise as a reader. I hope you can sympathise at different times with different characters, understanding why they make imperfect choices. I've been so interested, and it's been wonderful. The more people read the book, the more different the opinions become. I think people have sympathised with different characters every single time. I've had different views on people's behaviour, and that's been wonderful to hear and to talk about. I think it's certainly the case that the parents, no one's going to use this novel as a parenting manual, that's for sure. All of the teenagers, to a greater or lesser extent, are having rather imperfect upbringings. But that, again, that goes to the heart of the book. The real theme in this book is responsibility. And
It sounds like you have sympathy for most of these characters that you've spent time with here.
no, I wouldn't go that far. I have sympathy with some of them more than others. I'm infuriated with most of their behaviour. But that's kind of the point of the book. These people they are making their own choices. Some, I would argue, are freer than others. Some are unhappy through their own actions, and others are trying to make the best of situations into which they have found that in which they found themselves unintentionally. But I think they're very human characters. I can find redeeming qualities in most of them, not all.
Can I just mention, as people who've read the Harry Potter books will know, you deal with very dark material, even though they're books for young people. But that is counterbalanced by the joy of the inventiveness of the magic that you come up with, the vocabulary, the terms, the tricks, the devices are a constant joy. Here you face the challenge of writing again about a rather dark subject, but without that joy of magic. It must be a challenge.
It was it, to be honest, that wasn't the challenge, because clearly this is such a different kind of book. The challenge in this, there were challenges with this book, but they were different ones. First of all, it's an ambitious book in the sense that I'm following a group. I don't have a central character. I'm following a group of people, and I have to reveal the inner workings of a lot of different minds,
Right.
very different minds. So that's challenging. The structure of the book was key. And that's a rather boring thing for most readers, but most writers will know that that's virtually everything. And so that was a challenge, and it's a very different kind of book. It's not such a linear book as the Harry Potter books. But where the light and dark comes from, this book does have humour in many places. It may be
Oh,
of a
sure.
dark kind, but there is humour in the Casual Vacancy. But it is dealing ultimately with quite a dark subject, and I can't apologise for that. I'm asking some questions about how much responsibility we have in this life for each other, and for our own happiness and our own health. So these are weighty questions, and there's not room for a lot of frivolity there, although I do think it's a funny book in a lot of places.
Oh, sure. There's a lot of dark humor. I wrote down another line here, involving a character who, in, involving a character who's actually involving a character who's introduced first. He tried to give his wife pleasure in little ways because he had come to realize after nearly 2 decades together how often he disappointed her in the big things. I'm afraid I read that to my
Well,
wife, and she was
oh,
amused.
okay. Well, there you go. I mean, I think that that's a more profound sentence than it. I mean, clearly, it is a humorous sentence on one level, but it's more profound in a sense that that line is written about the character who drops dead, and superficially, they appear to the outside world to have a perfect marriage, but Barry himself is aware that there's a mismatch in what they think should take up most space in life, and that certainly becomes clear as the book progresses.
I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but there's a young man named Andrew who undermines his father, starts sending out email that is damaging to his father and causes him damage. And then you have this line here about the teenager. He thought it was all over, finished, done with. Andrew had never yet had reason to observe the first tiny bubble of fermenting yeast in which was contained an inevitable alchemical transformation. And it's almost like Harry Potter-style magic transformed to real life. You do some small thing and you have no idea what consequences may come afterward.
Well, I'm glad you've... I'm glad you've read that line, actually, not because it's got the word alchemical in it, but because it goes to the heart of these teenage characters, that they are this curious mix, which I think is very characteristic of adolescence, of being truth seekers in the way that adolescents often are. They crave the big picture, they crave the grand gesture. And they often go to the heart of things. In this book, a couple of times, I have my teenage characters groping for truths that the adults are simply blind to. Yet at the same time, they have very little empathy, which I think is true of a lot of teenagers. In fact, I think it's almost an inevitable side effect of being an adolescent, that you don't quite understand the damage you can do. And that's Andrew. You know, he's a character I think a lot of people will sympathise with. His father is a brutal man. He terrorises the family. Andrew wants to strike back. He wants to stop something happening that he thinks will be catastrophic for the family. And in doing so, he causes a huge amount of damage that Andrew himself didn't foresee. But, you know, that's kids. That's a 16-year-old boy who's desperate. So my sympathy is with Andrew. But, again... as you say, we root for the teenagers because of their youth, and perhaps I hope because we sense their fragility.
Hmm. What are your have your kids read this?
My eldest daughter has; she's 19. I would not recommend it for a 7 and 9-year-old, which is what my other two children are.
No, of course not. What does your eldest daughter think?
She had a curious reaction. Actually, she came to me and she said, "I finished it." And I said, right. And she said, I cried. And I said, good, because I don't think I could. Yeah, I would have been very surprised if she hadn't. And then she said, it's made me realize how much I don't know. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, and then she talked about some of the characters in the book. And we had actually a very interesting conversation because Jessica can remember our lives changing very dramatically. But she wasn't old enough when we left a life of real poverty to remember some of what I can remember. And I suppose this book brought it home to her, what kind of existence we could have had, actually.
But she remembers a little.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She was 4 or 5 when our fortunes really changed. And she can remember the flat we were living in when Harry Potter was published. And she can remember me getting the deal that meant we could buy our own house, which looked impossible at one point. I didn't think we were going to own our own house, maybe ever.
Let me just ask you, about one other thing, if I might. One of the things on which this book turns is a dispute over real estate, a long-running dispute over real estate.
Right, yeah.
That's an expression of the class differences. People don't like the poor people's housing being built down the street in their town. Is there any experience you've had that informs that?
Not a direct experience in my life, except that my school, the school that I went to in my teens, was in the middle of a housing estate.
Which is what Americans would call public housing projects.
Right, public housing, exactly. Yeah, I was groping for whatever the American translation is. We call it council housing, you call it public housing, yeah. So in fact, one of my best friends lived in one of the council houses very near our school. It wasn't, I hasten to add, an estate like the Fields in the book is a pretty rough place. Mm-hmm. And it's one of these estates that do exist in England, and I know exist in America, which have become almost ghetto-like. The housing is substandard, and the most problematic families tend to have been funneled in there. you know, this is a social problem and it causes other social problems. So no, I haven't lived on such an estate personally, but I certainly have been friends with a lot of people who have.
Yeah. And when it gets into property, that does trigger a lot of people's anxieties and obsessions. It's a real emotional thing.
Oh my
thing
goodness, we have one newspaper here in Britain. The joke about it is that every news story, be it what's happening in Libya or, you know, stories about the space station, is always related to what effect it has on the value of your property. I mean, it's an obsession, isn't it? It's a middle class obsession, and certainly in this book, that's very clear.
Have you spent any time thinking about how the critics might receive this book?
Surprisingly little. I mean, obviously, I'm aware that very soon now, which I'm quite excited about, the book will be out there and everyone can read it, which will be great, because I've been working on it on and off for five years, so it's been a long time in the making. I truly don't mean this in any kind of an arrogant way. But I feel very liberated at the moment, and whatever the reviewers feel about The Casual Vacancy, it is what I wanted it to be, and you can't say fairer than that as a writer. So if they like it, that will be wonderful. If they don't like it, that will be okay, and I'll just keep writing what I'm writing at the moment, and on I'll go. And I do feel that I'm a very lucky, lucky person in all sorts of ways. And one of the ways in which I'm fortunate is Harry Potter set me free to write whatever I want to write. I don't, you know, we're not living hand to mouth. I can afford to pay all of my bills. And now my writing life is a great experience. I can really do whatever I want to do. So I'm a very fortunate person. I'm a fortunate writer.
Thanks very much for the time.
Steve, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.